From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, Fit For You explores the nature of timing and our health, specifically our circadian rhythms.
Every cell in your body is a clock. It knows what time of day it is, and all these cells are kind of orchestrated and regulated by what we call a master clock in the brain.
Then Lindsay Anderson from Milwaukee Magazine gives us an inside look into the breaking, not break dancing, history right here in Milwaukee.
I think they associate it with these kids from the Bronx that were up to no good, and they didn't really appreciate that the fact that it is as creative and as demanding as any other art form.
We learn why you can't nail lithium batteries, and Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild joins us to share his September Milwaukee Music Roundup. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. How are you feeling right about now? You a little tired, ready to tackle the day, or hungry? Well, how you're feeling right now probably has a lot to do with circadian timing, or your inner clock. All of our cells and body functions fluctuate over the course of the day. But how are our circadian rhythms regulated? And how does our modern life affect how our bodies adjust? Recent studies suggest that disrupting our inner clocks is linked to health issues like obesity, heart disease, depression, and more. But science is also helping us utilize our inner clocks to create new therapies that impact how to best take medications, when to eat, when to sleep, and how we can work best so that we can feel better. Two people involved in this work are Dr. Jennifer Evans and Dr. Deanna Arble of Marquette University. They join me for this month's Fit For You, and they study the impacts of circadian networks in our body. Dr. Evans starts by explaining what exactly circadian rhythms are.
Basically, it's how our body knows what time it is. So nearly everything in our body fluctuates over the course of the day. So basic, like blood pressure, body temperature, cognitive function. So you most likely have experienced this because 2 o'clock in the morning, it's kind of hard to focus. And so those are your daily rhythms. There are optimal times to do things, and then there are suboptimal times to do things.
And where do the, say, commands and the natural rhythm of these things originate from? What's the mothership, so to speak?
Well, it's basically a property of every cell in your body. Every cell in your body is a clock. It knows what time of day it is, and all these cells are kind of orchestrated and regulated by what we call a master clock in the brain. And this master clock knows what's going on in the environment and then tells the rest of the tissues in your body when they should be doing things.
So the master clock has the slightly bigger influence on telling our cells what to do, even if our cells kind of inherently know on a base level what time it is?
Yeah, it's kind of like the master regulator. So it's a really nice analogy is one of an orchestra. So the orchestra has many instruments and components, but they need to be coordinated by a conductor. And so the master clock is like the conductor. He's setting the tempo and running the show. But each of the individual instruments can still play all by themselves.
Okay, that's a great way to look at it. So you mentioned it's all in our cells. Could you take us through the different function of circadian timing on the different levels within our body? So there's molecular, cellular, and then how it influences our behaviors.
So I'm a little bit more of an expert on the tissue and broad behavioral level. And I really like the analogy of the orchestra. Because the other thing that I would mention about that is that each of your different tissues could function as a different player of the orchestra. I'm a viola player myself, and I tend to like the liver and pancreas. So I imagine that the liver and pancreas are the cello and the viola sections, right? And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because these different tissues, they can have different optimal times. And that's actually how it should be for the music to sound the best. You don't want all the different sections playing the exact same tune. Everything has to be optimized, but synchronized to that master circadian clock in the brain. The tissues have an individual function which is optimized for that tissue. So, for example, if we're looking at the pancreas, where its chief function is to release insulin, and insulin is responsible for helping to regulate your glucose levels, there are different times a day when insulin secretion occurs more or less, and there's also different times a day where insulin sensitivity is increased. So, for example, an individual eating the breakfast will show an increased insulin release and slightly increased insulin sensitivity than if they were eating the exact same meal at another time of day. So this would mean very, very broadly that the best time of day for your pancreas would be in the morning. So this is at a very tissue level. At a broader level in terms of overall physiology and behavior, it depends on what output measure you're looking at. So Jen's already mentioned cognition and alertness, which tends to be highest during the day. 10 a.m. tends to be the peak time when people are awake. And importantly, part of this idea of the circadian rhythmicity, that it's happening on a daily basis and in a predictable basis, is that 10 a.m. is not synchronized based on when you woke up. It's synchronized based on the light-dark cycle. So this means that if you're a shift worker and you're waking up at 9 p.m. instead of 9 a.m., your optimal time is not going to be 10 p.m. It's still going to be the 10 a.m. that you missed. So that's another important differentiation here. And all of this comes to bear when you're thinking about the broad behavior and how all these different tissue organs are working together.
If I could just add something. So there's an adage that comes to mind. So the early bird gets the worm, right?
Sure, yeah.
So this system that we're talking about, it allows us to anticipate important events in our environment. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to be the early bird and get that worm, your body has to wake up and mobilize itself in order to perform optimally. And so the system allows us to anticipate these important events rather than just react to them. So when the sun rises, you're not playing catch up. Your body is already there, ready to capitalize on the resources that are available. And so the example of insulin is a really good one, because we eat at certain times, our body anticipates this, and it starts to produce insulin in advance, mm-hmm. so that when we do eat, it is already primed and ready to take advantage of the calories that we're consuming.
I do want to touch back on timing and the body when it comes to medicine and the things that our body needs. But before we get there, you mentioned that all these cells are communicating, you know, and is it unique for this master clock to have this level of communication with our cells in our body? Is there any other system in our body that compares on the level of, you know, could we say intelligence that circadian rhythm cells have with one another?
I would say communication among cells is a general property of our body. Every tissue in our body is a collection of cells. And if they were just doing their own thing and not coordinating as a tissue, it wouldn't be effective. So it's a general property. In the circadian system, the master clock is unique because its cells talk among themselves. And so they talk among themselves, coordinate so that they can kind of form this strong population capable of sending coherent, cohesive signals to the rest of the body. Where, like the cells in your pancreas, the individual cells are functional, capable clocks, but they don't necessarily talk to one another in the same way. So they rely on the master clock for these signals to kind of keep them in line.
And would you say the master clock and the circadian cells, that it's a flexible system?
Yes. It's designed to adjust to the environment. So when we travel across time zones, it adjusts. It adjusts with the seasons. So it's a very flexible system. But like any biological system, if you push it too far, it will break.
Right. And with our modern lives, you know, obviously our circadian rhythms are going to be different compared to, say, 1840, when we are rising with the sun, going to bed with the sun, less artificial light. Our jobs itself are different. So what factors of today's modern life would you say have the biggest disruptive impact on circadian timing?
So the biggest disruptor is definitely going to be light. Light at the wrong time of days. And the biggest one that I think a lot of us are guilty of is looking at our phones or screens during the dark. So this is your TV, your computer screens, your phones. And this is partly because not only are they emitting light, but they're emitting this blue wavelength of light, which is responsible for adjusting our circadian clock. And so this is causing a disruption in our circadian rhythms. And as you mentioned, a long time ago, this light at night and this artificial lighting was not a problem. And it is something fairly new for our bodies to handle. For the most part, you know, the light at night does not break our system. It just causes unnecessary readjustment and retraining. And it's this constant readjustment and potentially desynchronizing our tissues. So we have some tissues that think it's one time of day and some that think that it's another, that's leading to the problem. So I think it's interesting here that it's not that our clock fails to work. It's that it's just... it just didn't expect to be in this environment where it was getting light so much. So it's trying its best to keep us healthy as best as possible.
Yeah, so the light exposure at night is basically like traveling across time zones.
Right.
So when you travel to France or Europe or Japan, you're getting light at a time that your body doesn't expect it. Mm-hmm. And so there's the process of jet lag, which is your body trying to adjust. Now, the thing about travel is that, you know, you stay in the time zone and your body is able to adjust. But when you use tablets or expose yourself to light at night, it's very chaotic. And so your system is trying to adjust, but there are conflicting signals. And so it's kind of like when we're exposing ourselves to light using these tablets, eating at the wrong time, these sorts of things, we're basically imposing jet lag on our bodies. And I'm sure you've experienced this. It's not a happy state to be in.
Right.
You're sleeping at the wrong time. You have like stomach problems, you know, all these things. And so we're introducing that into our daily lives when we engage in practices like that.
I bet people don't think of it as self-imposed jet lag.
We'll
change our habits with that picture in mind. And we all perhaps have felt jet lag at some point in our lives from traveling. But what other physical symptoms do we feel like if our, quote, timing is off?
So one of the first things that you might feel if your timing is off is it tends to be gastrointestinal distress. And this could express itself in a variety of ways. But one of the things it could also do is it could change your appetite. So you could find yourself much more hungrier than usual, or you can find yourself just not interested in eating whatsoever. And there's actually some really interesting hypotheses about why your gut is one of the first things to indicate to you that something's not quite right. And I'm thinking, and this is most predominant in the extreme situations such as night shift work, so people that are awake and active during the wrong time of day, or during pretty extreme jet lag, so crossing many, many time zones. And one of the hypotheses for why this occurs is because when you land at your destination and have crossed, let's say, 8 time zones, your master circadian clock, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, trains and adjusts to that new cycle very fast. It's very good at its job. But as following with the orchestra analogy again, the ability for that master clock to then disseminate that timing information to these other peripheral clocks and peripheral tissues, those other tissues are a bit slow in the uptake. So while the master clock entrains quickly, these other tissues could take multiple days in order to finally get in line and be playing the tune that they need to be playing at the right time of day. And the gut and the liver are fairly slow to entrain, can take probably 3 days or so. Whereas other clocks in your system can entrain a little bit faster, a little bit slower. The gut is on the slower side. So it could be why this is one of the things that you feel the most, because it's one of the tissues that's most misaligned to that new time of day. Interestingly, some there's some data that suggest if you want to re-entrain to your jet lag faster, to even prior to your trip, to start eating at the correct time of day for your new schedule. So if you're going to France, to start eating at the normal French breakfast time, even before you've left. And this is an important and really important studies that have looked at this. And this is partly because not only does light serve as a timing cue for the body, but food is actually a very important one, too.
Right. And with this component of health, you mentioned it's important for eating, for medications, you know, and we look at a prescription that says take twice a day.
Right.
Doesn't specify all optimal times. But, you know, do you think this component of circadian timing has been largely left out of health and wellness, you know, when it comes to prescribing medications, when it comes to imposing a new fitness regime or eating plan?
I think that we're getting better at recognizing the importance of circadian rhythms, but we're not really where we should be yet. We're recognizing the importance of having a circadian light cycle in hospitals to help people recover and to help them get the maximum benefit of their treatment while in the hospital. We're understanding the importance of eating at the right time of day, and we're starting to understand the importance of chronotherapy. So this is making sure that your drugs are delivered an optimal time of day for you. And this is based on the drug target as well as your own circadian rhythm.
No, I completely agree. So we're getting better at it. But I think for many reasons, it's oftentimes difficult to take time into consideration. When you look at the science, there's a lot of data to justify taking time into consideration. But then when you look to put it into practice, there are some obstacles that need some creative solutions. And we're still working on finding the right balance between the biology, the economics, and the social obligations.
You both are studying this in-depthly, but what can someone like myself do in their everyday lives to optimize their body's natural circadian timing?
I think that the quick and hopefully easy one is to minimize your light exposure at night. If you absolutely have to have light at night, they have some blue blocking glasses that you can wear, and this will at least filter out the blue light, which is responsible for readjusting your circadian clock. So that's one possibility.
I think it all depends on what schedule you need to impose. So if you need to wake up early for your job, then you need to wake up early and get some bright light exposure in the morning. But if you're a bartender and you need to stay up late, then maybe you need to shift your wake-up times later so that your body actually matches your schedule. And then avoid all cues that are going to conflict with that schedule. So if you need to be a morning person, don't eat late at night. Don't drink caffeine late at night. Do not have bright light exposure. There are practical, like, technological advances that will help us do this. But there's really not one schedule that is best for everybody. And that's one of the things that I think is the most interesting. Some of us are early birds, some of us are night owls, and it really traces back to the biology of the system. It's in our genes.
So if I stay up too late, I can maybe say it's in my genes, but not eat all the snacks at 10:30. Well, Jennifer Evans and Deanna Arbol, thank you both so much for coming in to talk about this today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Dr. Jennifer Evans and Dr. Deanna Arbol study circadian timing at Marquette University. They join me in the studio, and you can find out more and explore past Fit for You segments at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we break down the breaking, not breakdancing, scene right here in Milwaukee. You're listening to Like Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Like Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's 1983, and a little film called Flashdance featured a dance style not quite yet popularized, breakdancing. While the style was developed in California in the 1960s and 70s, the film catapulted breaking into the spotlight around the world. The Bronx was also a hub for the art of breaking, but what you may not know is that it also has deep roots and influence right here in Milwaukee. It was first introduced here 45 years ago, and many of the region's best dancers have made the city home. Milwaukee Magazine's Lindsay Anderson looked into the history of breaking in Milwaukee and some of its most influential local talents of the art form. She joins me in the studio now to tell us more. Lindsay Anderson, welcome back to Lake Effect.
It's great to be here.
So before we get into the story, let's set the record straight. It's breaking, not breakdancing, right?
Yes. To be fair, some breakers are okay with the term breakdancing, but it's not what they originally called themselves. It's a term that the media invented and popularized, so most prefer breaking.
Okay, and what role did the media play in getting this into the pop culture sphere?
Yeah, well, originally in the mid-1970s, it was entirely underground. The art form took off initially in the Bronx and then fairly quickly spread throughout the rest of the country. And Milwaukee was actually one of the cities that had it spread to it the earliest. But then in the early 80s, when films like Flashdance sort of surprisingly came out and featured cameos from prominent breakers, then everyone, the rest of the country and the world sort of learned about it and quickly became a bit obsessed with it. And then that's when the media started talking about it a lot.
Which is pretty fascinating because all I remember is the cameo of mainly the little boy breaking.
And yes.
I'm sure if we went back and looked at it, we would notice some adults that are prominent.
Actually, in the finale, when you see what looks like the star leap into this really impressive jump and spin around on the ground, that's actually a male breaker.
Yep.
That's crazy legs.
Yeah. Jennifer Beals.
Yep.
Yeah, one of my favorites.
Yeah.
But back to breaking. One man that is of great influence in Milwaukee in particular, bringing his breaking scene from the Bronx here, is Efren Manzanet Jr., also known as the Godfather. So what's his history?
Well, he was born in the Bronx, and he was a teenager who would attend house parties, some of those initial house parties where DJs would start spinning records and start breaking down songs. So he was there right at the beginning, basically, in the early 70s when DJs like Clive Cool Herc Campbell started creating breaks that would eventually turn into breaking. Yeah, and then so he moved to Milwaukee when he was still very young in the mid-70s, and he started showing people these moves that he'd picked up at those house parties, these moves he'd learned to dance to during the breaks of the songs. And people were initially a little bit confused by them, but they soon, they were intrigued too. And so he was pretty quickly able to get enough people interested to start his own breaking crew.
What I found really interesting is his role in making breaking a business, and also just, you know, people would have the misconception that it's not an esteemed group, it's not something to be taken, quote, seriously, but the way he approached things was really quite different.
Yeah, so he created this group called the Magic Rockers. He would have them practice almost every day of the week, actually, for several hours at the time. They would have to audition to be a member of the crew, and he would fine them for not showing up on time. So he took it very seriously. But he did that in part because there was so much demand for breaking, especially, again, after movies like Flashdance came out and everyone in America was suddenly obsessed with it, that he knew that he had to treat it very seriously. And he was able to book these kids that he worked with gigs at very large concert halls. Initially, they did a lot of roller rink shows, but they were able to quickly work their way up from there. They opened for Grandmaster Flash. They opened for New Edition. They played on Lambeau Field. So they were a really big deal, especially in the mid-80s.
Now, in that period before kind of exploding, what misconceptions about, you know, B-boys and B-girls were there?
Well, I think especially then, but to some degree, even now, a lot of people just fundamentally don't understand hip hop as an art form. Breaking is one of the essential elements of hip hop, along with MCing and rapping and graffiti art. And I think they associate it with these kids from the Bronx that were up to no good, and they didn't really appreciate that the fact that it is as creative and as demanding as any other art form. And I mean, breaking especially, to be really good at it, you have to devote hundreds, if not thousands, of hours to perfecting these moves. The people who win competitions will spend 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a day, day after day, practicing to perfect the dance. And that's really what you have to do.
Well, and I, you know, could almost liken it to gymnastics and the hours and dedications and physicality it takes to accomplish that.
Yeah, so people don't, they think of it as just sort of this silly thing you break out at parties. And to be fair, some people, not everyone is going to devote their life to the dance form. But to get really good at it, you have to be willing to pour that much time and effort into it.
What surprised you as you were working on this piece?
Well, that was definitely one of the things. I would also say I was surprised by how big the scene in Milwaukee still is. So it initially kind of blew up in the 80s, and then people got a little bit sick of it. Or I guess I should just say the rest of the average American suddenly lost interest in it. But there were always breakers out there who were perfecting their moves. They just kind of went underground again. But then around mid to late 90s again, you started to see a resurgence in it. And around that time, there were a couple crews that formed in Milwaukee that are still around today.
How many are still active today?
There are three right now that are still pretty active. And one of them is helmed up by this guy who goes by Miho. His real name is Juan. But he's widely considered one of the best breakers in the Midwest. He's in his 30s now, but he still competes with the best of them. He's representing the Midwest in a competition that's coming up. So, yeah, it's a little surprising, but Milwaukee has a great reputation as a city for breaking and we're really on the map for it.
Well, and I found it interesting that Mitchell Street has played such a prominent role in the history of breaking here. Can you dive into that a little bit?
Yeah, I think in part it might have had a little bit to do with the fact that Efren initially moved there. But also, it's worth noting, initially, breaking was an art form that was predominantly practiced by people of sort of Afro-Caribbean descent and Puerto Rican descent specifically, and then it obviously spread out from there. But Mitchell Street in the 70s and 80s, because it did have such a thriving Puerto Rican population, there were just a lot of people there who were interested and I think felt like it was part of their culture that they could be proud of and that they wanted to take part in and learn.
With the trajectory of breaking, not just went from its founding on the East Coast, but then coming to the Midwest. You mentioned in the article that the more popular it became, the more artistic credibility it lost.
Yes.
Is that the case today, or is it ebbing and flowing? Do you see any kind of cyclical patterns?
Yeah, I think we've gotten to a point today where it's relatively popular, but people are finally starting to respect it as a serious art form. I mean, like I said, in the 80s, I think people just thought of it as this novelty. It was a fun trick to bust out at parties. So they didn't really take it especially seriously. Nowadays, though, there's a good chance it's going to end up in the next summer Olympic Games in Paris. There are breaking competitions around the world. Red Bull sponsors a huge one. So there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are dancing at a very high level. And I think finally people are starting to realize exactly how much work goes into it and are starting to respect it. And so it's been able to achieve some degree of popularity again without kind of while still being taken seriously.
Sure. One part of that element of gaining respect is just getting to know the people, the artists behind it. And you highlight quite a few people in the Milwaukee area. One is Crumbles, another woman by the name of La Katrina Flores. But both of them bring up that there still needs to be more emphasis on inclusivity.
Yes. I mean, Katrina Flores will say there aren't a lot of female B-girls still. They've been around since the beginning of the art form. They've always been there, but the art form is still dominated by men. So she's a B-girl herself, but she also puts on a lot of events and MCs a lot of events and hosts them. And I think one of the things she's pushing to do is make the art form more inclusive and open it up to women especially, but really all people everywhere. And as you mentioned, that's something that Crumbles is also interested in.
He actually went viral a couple years ago. He was participating in a sort of like halftime contest at a Bucks game where the winner, it was a dance contest, and the winner was going to win free pizza from Palermo's for a year. And he went out there, and as he describes himself as a bigger guy, someone that you wouldn't necessarily assume is going to be an amazing dancer. But he'd been studying breaking for years, and he was basically able to mop up the floor with everyone else. He just crushed the competition. And he's also very upfront about the fact that he would like to see the art form be more inclusive of people of all shapes and sizes, abilities. There's no reason that everyone shouldn't be able to enjoy it.
Do you think most readers will be surprised and learn a lot from this article? What do you hope people will take away?
Yeah, I just hope people get excited for the breaking scene in Milwaukee and realize that there is a scene here and that there are classes that you can take. True School, the organization, offers a lot of great classes. You can enroll in them yourself. If you've got kids, you can sign them up for it. There are also breaking battles that happen pretty often throughout the city. There's a big one coming up in November. It's called Kingdom Wars, and it's going to be at the Jan Sayre Studio November 15th and 16th. So I would just encourage people, if they're interested, to check out those battles and maybe check out classes too.
Well, Lindsay, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Lindsay Anderson is the senior editor of Milwaukee Magazine and also covers arts and culture. Her article, The Big Break, is featured in this month's issue. We'll take another break, and then Lake Effect essayist Judy Steininger explains why you can't mail your lithium batteries or put them in your checked luggage. Lake Effect returns in a moment, here on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. You know the drill. Shoes and belts off, laptops out of your bag, 4 ounces or less of liquids. Flying has lost whatever romance it once had. But what's the deal with batteries? Why can't you just put them in your checked baggage? Well, Lake Effect essayist Judy Steininger explains.
Lithium. You may not know what it is, but you frequently answer questions about your possession of it. At the post office, the clerk asks if it's in the package you're mailing. At the airport, agents ask, is there any in your checked baggage? You put minute amounts of it next to your ear every time you use your cell phone. So, what is lithium? Why is it important to us? And what makes it so potentially dangerous? Lithium is an element used in batteries to power everything from cars to cell phones. Lithium has a weight advantage. The more something weighs, the more energy is required to power it. A conventional lead-acid battery in the average car weighs approximately 40 pounds. Early cell phones required a carrying case the size of a bowling ball bag. Now, thanks to lithium, we can slip a cell phone into an evening purse or a hip pocket. Sounds great, right? So why do we get quizzed about shipping or bag-checking devices with lithium batteries in them? Let's have a brief chemistry lesson. Lithium is one of the 118 elements which alone or in infinite combinations form everything in our universe. On the periodic table of the elements, lithium appears on the far left side in a vertical column labeled Group 1A. Elements in Group 1A, lithium, sodium, potassium, rubidium, cesium, and francium, are known as alkali metals. They are highly reactive. In chemistry, reactive means an element undergoes a chemical reaction by itself or with other elements and releases energy. Cesium explodes in water. Gold is very unreactive, hence your ring is made of it. The alkali metals are highly reactive because each of their atoms has one negatively charged electron positioned far from the nucleus containing the positive protons. Such elements quickly spin off those electrons to become more stable. Nonmetal elements quickly incorporate electrons to make themselves stable. This flow of electrons from the atoms of one element to another can create compounds like salt, electricity, energy release, among other things. Lithium spins off that lone electron so fast it burns at room temperature the instant it is not coated in something thick like mineral oil. Lithium is also the lightest metal in the world, and so soft it can be cut with a dull kitchen knife. These characteristics are what make lithium so terrific for batteries. Low weight and lots of energy packed in. So, a tiny cell phone battery contains a positive electrode made of some lithium oxide, a negative electrode made of a lithium and graphite compound, and an electrolyte, another lithium compound through which the electrons flow while the device is either discharging or charging. Electric cars might use different lithium compounds, but the principle is the same. The little chemical factory bonus in your devices is they can have electrons flowing in two directions, meaning when one goes dead, just recharge by plugging into a socket. That forces the electrons to flow in reverse. Nevertheless, treat your lithium batteries nicely. Don't pound them with a hammer, cut them, or overheat. If their seal is broken, the lithium is still highly reactive to the air. This is a fire you don't want to play with. The battery industry reports the chances of your phone spontaneously exploding is 1 in 1,000,000. But now you see the danger in any kind of shipping. The possibility of rough handling or excess heat could cause problems, especially in the hold of a plane. In your aisle seat, you could notice and extinguish. Better, more powerful battery technology is the holy grail for our mobile computerized society. Entire libraries and research facilities exist on this topic. We've scarcely touched the surface, but now you know why you get quizzed.
Lake Effect essayist Judy Steininger is a professor emerita at the Milwaukee School of Engineering, where she also leads the Great Books Dinner Discussion Series. Coming up next, Milwaukee Records Matt Wild joins us for the September Milwaukee Music Roundup. So stick around. Lake Effect will be right back after this short break. You're listening to us on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues here on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Matt Wild is one of the co-founders of Milwaukee Record, which he and the other co-founder, Tyler Moss, describe as an online source for music, culture, and gentle sarcasm. Among the many cultural things Milwaukee Record keeps track of is a nearly exhaustive list of new music from local musicians. In August, Lake Effect started a partnership with Milwaukee Record based on that list called Milwaukee Music Roundup. And Matt joins Lake Effect's Bonnie North now for round three.
Hey, Matt, how are you?
Hello, I am doing very well, thank you.
Oh, my goodness, it is September and almost October.
The waning days of September.
Waning days.
We're going into October. I've already been celebrating Halloween for a full month.
Have you?
Looking forward to the real deal now in October.
Are you going trick-or-treating?
Oh, I love trick-or-treating. I have a little girl, and we go with her cousin. And, oh, it's a delight. And I love going in my hometown where adults are also out providing, shots of alcohol to go along with the candy for mom and dad.
For mom and dad. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
It's great. I don't know who invented that, but, you know.
But you want to say thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Exactly. Well, by the time we talk next, you might have already done the Halloween thing.
Very true.
Yeah. But we need to talk about what happened in September and some interesting... It's a really interesting mix this month.
It is. It is a very eclectic mix. And I guess we can just kind of kick right off here. The first thing, when I first suggested this artist, I didn't realize that mere days after I suggested we talk about her song that she would be coming in here to the studio to perform some of her songs. Not the one we'll be listening to today, but I'm talking about Mariel Allschwang and her band The Visitations. They just put out an album called Procession of a Day, The World of Mary Knoll. Now, not only was this and is this an album, it was a multimedia performance at the Oriental a few days ago, and I checked it out, and it was pretty great, really wonderful. And Marielle has been kicking around town for a long time now, and she is, I think, one of our very best singers, our very best songwriters, and she's always been absolutely uncompromising in the stuff that she writes and performs, and kind of pairing herself up with Mary Knoll, who we all may know lived in Fox Point and was kind of this local legend. Her house, which was decorated with all her her artworks, was kind of known locally as the Witch's House, and it was kind of this place where kids would go and, oh, let's look for the witch kind of thing. And she passed away in 2001, I believe, and left behind all this artwork. And Mariel, years later, decided to kind of, explore that. And the performance at the Oriental was lovely. Her and her band performed all 12 tracks, I believe, from this album. And there was an accompanying film strip running on the screen. And
Why did you pick this particular song?
This particular song is called Rome, and it jumped out at me because the opening lines, and in fact the closing lines, are from the B-52s song Rome. What is the opening? I hear the wind, it's whispering, something like that, and you think it's going to be a cover of Rome, and it is not. Kind of goes into Marielle's own thing, and I also like in the song that she names herself by name. She uses her own name in the song, and I think that's lovely, and it's a really interesting reworking of the B-52's Rome. Go figure.
That was Mariel Allschwang and The Visitations with their song Rome, from Procession of a Day, The World of Mary Knoll. And we will say that she performed more of those songs from that album in the studio next door just a little while ago, and we will link to that as well if you're interested in hearing more of her music, and I highly recommend it. So we move from that very meditative, very interesting, to something that is not.
No, absolutely not, no. Not that it's that crazy, but
it is a shift.
It is a brand new band. The name of the band is Some Strange Kaleidoscope, and the song we'll be listening to is called Patina Screamer. Now, Some Strange Kaleidoscope has members of an old band that a lot of Milwaukeeans may be familiar with. The old band was called the Rashida Joneses, which is just a delightful name. And two of the folks from the Rashida Joneses. And they were always very, very busy. They played a ton of shows back in the day. They put on their own festival for their kind of DIY label that they had. And they were very, very busy. And then they kind of just disappeared. And now, kind of out of the blue, two of the folks from that band have gotten back together. And they're putting together this new project called Some Strange Kaleidoscope. And it's not just a kind of a psychedelic rock band. It's a full, I guess there's a theme running through the show, a multimedia experience. I just want to read something that they have for this song and for their upcoming album. The duo has been in the warehouse developing videos, audio-responsive DMX light patches, sculptures, paintings, installations, interactive web media, animations, and a number of additional hidden elements to the project. The Patina Screamer album art exists outside of the digital rendering as a physical installation of carpentry and acrylic, supplemented via an oil-on-canvas backdrop repurposed from espresso rucksacks. Now, that's not just your normal band.
That's not your normal band. And I have to say, what was the thing about the light?
The audio responsive DMX light patches?
I think that's a good album name.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think, yeah. DMX, if he hasn't picked up on that, he could use that as well.
Absolutely.
So and this is just a great song. It's not too crazy, but it is a swirling psychedelic fun house of a song, and I'm really looking forward to what these folks are up to in the future.
All right, here it is. Patina Screamer from Some Strange Kaleidoscope. I really like that.
It is a fun song.
It is a fun song, and they sound like a fun band. I want to see this installation.
I'm very interested in what they're up to. I should say their website alone is, if you go to it, is kind of a psychedelic experience in and of itself. It's a real trippy kind of experience. So if that's any indication, I think we can expect great things from Some Strange Kaleidoscope.
All right. Well, now we move again, almost 180 degrees, mm-hmm. to a very, very different sound, Yodot.
Yodot, yes. Yodot, for the longest time, probably in the early years of this decade, in the early 2010s, was, I think, at least to my mind, one of the bigger names in Milwaukee hip-hop, putting out a lot of projects and was just always popping up on other people's tracks, too. And then for the last few years, he's been kind of quiet. And I know he's been raising some children. I know he has a son. And he'd pop up here and there, but haven't heard much from him lately. Until now, he's back with a new EP that he just put out. The name of the EP is Self Checkout. And the song we're going to be listening to is called Forever, with the numeral 4 kicking that off. And it is... I don't know. It's a perfect kind of late summer, early fall jam for me. Very kind of lovely little melody, very simple melody of great lyrics about not wanting to die and wanting to live forever. And who can't get behind that? That's a lovely little melodic part to the song. And then Yodot has some great verses where he raps on here. He's always been terrific. So it's nice to see him back and kind of putting out a new project. A great name in Milwaukee hip hop. Great to see him back. I don't want to ever die. I want to live forever. I want to live forever.
Yeah. Taking advantage of life. Cause nothing is promised. More I progress in this life, it just seems like to me that it's nothing is honest. The rougher the climate, the harder the fight. Took all of the punches, I'm jabbing my left and I'm guarding my right. The Lord is my shepherd wherever I go when I walk through the night. The energy back, not feeling the vibe.
That was Yodot with Forever. And listening to that track, I'm reminded of, I mean, there's history of hip-hop in there. It's melodic. It's got some really wonderful rhythmic things going on. There's mm-hmm. a lot of great sampling. I think it's great stuff. And you're right, it's great that he's back on the scene.
It is, yeah. He's, like I said, he's kind of a scene veteran, and it's fun to see him back with a new project.
Cool. Well, again, we make another turn into something very, very different to wrap up this month. And this is a band that actually got together thanks to a rock and roll camp, right?
That's right. The name of the band is Negative Positive. And they got together at a Girls Rock Milwaukee camp back in 2013 when the members, and it's a trio, the members were only 8, 9, and 10 years old. So it's been all of 6 years since they got together. So you can age them up by 6 years now. And they're, you know, they were children, now they're teenagers. And They've been playing for, you know, 6 years, and they've changed a lot. And what's interesting about Negative Positive, they also play a ton. If you've been to any kind of a street fest or block party in the past few years, chances are you've seen them play, and they play out a lot. And they're terrific. And they're getting to that point where their backstory really doesn't matter that much anymore. It used to be, you know,
it was a novelty.
It was a novelty. It was, oh, a bunch of little kids playing instruments. Isn't that nice? And now, but even then, you know, they were good and they showed a lot of potential. And now I think they're definitely on their way to just leaving the whole, oh, we're kids with guitars and, you know, drums, leaving that behind. And certainly they still have, you know, their entire lives ahead of them. And, I'm really excited to see what they do in the next, you know, 5, 10, 15 years.
And they're writing their own stuff.
They are writing their own stuff. And their past stuff has always been kind of punky and kind of, you know, poppy and kind of indie rocky.
Jangly a little.
Yes. Yeah. This new song that they just put out is called Space Smells Like Lilacs. Is kind of a turn for them. It's kind of a, I suppose you could call it a ballad almost. It's kind of this jazzy kind of slow tempo ballad. And, you know, it's, I suppose you could say it's one of those things where a band is maturing, you know,
our very eyes.
No longer 8 years old. Now right. They're 16. So I think it's been really wonderful watching this band progress. And like I said, kind of slowly putting the novelty behind them. You know, they're no longer just a bunch of little kids who met at a camp. And they've always been a legitimate band, and they certainly play out a ton. And so this new song, Space Smells Like Lilacs, I think is a good indication of what we can look forward to in the future.
Great. And that is what's going to take us out this month. Matt Wild, it is always great to have you in the studio, and I look forward to next month.
It's always great to be invited. Thank you very much.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month, he publishes his Milwaukee Music Roundup, and we feature a few of the songs from that list on the show. You can find a link on WUWM.com to the songs we featured today, as well as a link to Matt's complete list on Milwaukee Record as well. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and won't you join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.